Welcome to the Observer's Film Weekly podcast, brought to you in association with Extras, the complete second series on DVD. For more information about Extras Season 2 on DVD or Ricky Gervais Live, please visit www.rickygervais.com. Hello and welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons, coming to you from the rejigged, rebranded hub of British film life, BFI South Bank. Yes, we go on the road for this special edition of Film Weekly. It's out with the old NFT and in with a new £6 million entrance hall, bookshop, cafe, mediatech and studio cinema. We tour the fantastic new building and interview award-winning guests, including Oscar winner Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck, writer and director of German film The Lives of Others, as well as British treasure Terence Davis, on the eve of a retrospective of his films down at BFI South Bank, including Distant Lives, Still Voices. All that plus a great BFI prize available to you on Film Weekly, on the road with me, Jason Solomons. Let's start in Berlin. Winner of the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film, The Lives of Others is set in East Germany during the 1980s when a spy for the secret police, the Stasi, suspects a prominent playwright of subversive activities. The spy bugs the artist's apartment, where he lives with one of East Berlin's leading and most beautiful actresses, and installs himself with his headphones and recording equipment in the empty attic to eavesdrop on every word uttered below. Gradually, Wiesel the spy becomes fascinated with the artistic freedoms banded about below. The music, the discussion of ideas, the sex. Could the lives of these others really be more attractive than the devotion to order and communism so required in a true patriot? The Lives of Others brilliantly conjures an other lost-worldly atmosphere of corridors and functional architecture. Corruption, moral and otherwise, creeps in at the edges, but essentially this is a filmed battle of ideologies. The triumph is to make that so watchable and finally so moving. The film won its debut writer-director, Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck, an Oscar recently, and we caught up with him at the National Film Theatre before another award ceremony. It's the Observer Film Weekly podcast special from BFI South Bank. We've moved again. We're in the green room here where the talent waits before they go onto the stages here at NFT1 to receive their prizes. And our next guest, Florian Donnersmarck, is about to receive a prize from Lord Attenborough.
That's right.
Congratulations on that.
Yeah, thank you very much.
This is the Satyajit Ray Prize, which you won already at the London Film Festival
Now going to be given. And I heard I'm going to be given a large version of it, which, however, they take away from me immediately, and then give me a miniature of it because the large version stays with the foundation and they only engrave the names on it.
There are some fantastic names on there, Florian. I don't know if you're aware that the legacy which you hold in your hands.
Yeah, I heard that Todd Fields is on it, Kimberly Pierce. No, it's a really good selection of people.
You've got Ozu on there, Bertolucci.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I mean, I didn't know that. No.
Really, really strong hands.
Okay, excellent.
But it's not the only award you've won, of course. I mean, the last time I saw you was on television very early in the morning for me, receiving the best foreign language Oscar.
Oh, that's right. You're one of the crazy people like me who get up in the middle of the night to watch the Oscars. Yeah,
always have done, always will do.
That's the same with me. I always watch it too. Yeah.
So to find yourself part of that must have been quite extraordinary.
Yeah. Oh, that was a great experience. But you know, it's going to be a great experience getting that prize from Lord Attenborough as well, because I don't know if you've been told that he was my mentor, my teacher. I interned with him as a directing intern in 1996 on his film of In Love and War, starring Sandra Bullock and Chris O'Donnell, and that was just a wonderful experience. So in a way, this is really some closure to me on an important chapter. this is like receiving my real film school diploma from my real teacher.
What did you learn from Lord Attenborough as you were working on that film?
I learned one very important thing, and that is that really it's all about the actors. Now, that sounds like a cliche, but it really is. It's a very important lesson, and I don't know if any of your listeners are filmmakers or aspiring filmmakers. I really think that is something that I would hope for them that they would take to heart, because I have visited many sets of friends, and I see that few directors actually do concentrate only on the actors during the shoot. Richard Attenborough's philosophy is that you have to have everything prepared beforehand, and when the actors come on set, it's only about them. And he, who is such an extremely polite person, he will almost have everything else fade out and just ignore everything else, everybody else, including the director of photography, and concentrate only on the actors. Everything else suddenly becomes, you know, not only secondary, but almost non-existent to him. And that is something that I've taken from Lord Attenborough and really absorbed. He used to say that acting for the camera is actually a pretty perverse thing, because acting is really something which should be done in an amphitheater in front of 10,000 people, where the actor would immediately feel the reaction from the public and then adapt his performance to really reach their hearts. And he says, now we've created this strange little machine which forces the actors to just act half a minute and be there completely alone without any audience. And he says the only real audience that they have is the director. And he says that what you should do as a director is replace that audience. Be those 10,000 people. Give them all the attention that those 10,000 people would be giving them, and make them feel exactly what you're feeling. You know, observing him, I think I learned in some way how to do that. And
well, I think it's very interesting, because in your film, certainly there's a lot of moments where we just see one man alone in a room. So presumably there was no audience. There was just you, the camera, yeah, and him, your lead actor Wiesel, as he's spying on the events below. An incredible intensity to those scenes without much happening, really, visually.
It's always important to me to somehow try and give the viewer that feeling that he's really watching something unobserved. It's strange. I always thought the ultimate idea of cinema would be to give someone the impression that he had a little secret microphone hidden in a confession booth there somewhere, you know, and you just hear people pouring out their hearts and just speaking from the bottom of their souls. And that's somehow what I tried to create on the screen. I want to give people the impression that they're seeing something very raw and very real. And I think that's the biggest challenge for a director, to try and make your actors behave like no one is watching, although you're watching, although the camera is watching, and although you have, you know, at least 50 technicians around at any given moment. And I think the director's skill, more than all the technical stuff, which of course you have to know, but anybody can learn that, I think the director's skill has to be to identify when suddenly something creeps in that would make you notice that the actor knows he's being watched.
I mean, it's an incredible thing to have half of your country taken up by a completely different regime, yeah, a completely yeah. different philosophy. It's an extraordinary thing that almost no one can even yeah. remember. I can't believe that for almost like half my life, that obtained in Europe, just over yeah. there, we used to play That's football true. Against, and they used to be in athletics meetings. They had all these people. How do you feel now about joining that country together? Is it a different country? I know the past is a foreign country, well, but is your next-door neighbour that
I mean, I was always very connected to the East, because both of my parents are from the East, and we had family and friends there, and I was there all the time. And I was living in West Berlin, which was this tiny island in the middle of the East. So I really knew the East quite well, and therefore for me it wasn't as much of a shock when it suddenly came together again as it was for many other people. But it was a crazy situation. I mean, I think besides us, it's only, you know, the Vietnamese or the Koreans who can understand that craziness. It really was madness.
Do you have any residual affection for East Germany? I mean, there's some of the films that come out, say Goodbye Lenin, makes a kind of nice, gentle comedy about it. In a way, you end up sort of yeah. regretting those days, those lovely days when we yeah. all lived in the same apartment and it was all the same size. Your film doesn't have that.
No, no.
And it has a very definite kind of sense that this yeah. was an oppressive regime that restricted yeah. the artists. You don't have any of that nostalgia, I think they call it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, you're right. I mean, that is a very prevailing feeling in Germany, or was, I like to flatter myself, until my film hit the screens. I have absolutely no nostalgia for that. I mean, it was a dictatorship that killed and tortured its enemies. No, I am so glad that it's gone and over. I really find that there's nothing good about it. This was a deeply immoral dictatorship that even called itself a dictatorship. It was called the dictatorship of the proletariat. That's an official Marxist term.
Well, I hope you didn't rule your set like that, although you did get a fantastic performance out of everyone involved and a great-looking film. We're going to have to leave it there because
Dickie
Attenborough is calling.
All right, okay.
And you must go collect your award. Yet another award. Yeah. For Ian.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
It's Film Weekly special from BFI Southbank. I'm seated with the artistic director of BFI Southbank, Eddie Berg. We're sitting in the MediaTek. Eddie, tell me what this room's about.
The MediaTek, Jason, is a brand new space on the BFI. It's a portal to the BFI National Film and Television Archive, where we've got 900,000 titles. So here you can see just a small selection of those titles on a number of computer screens. So we've got about 300 titles arranged into different programs, some features, some shorts, documentaries, animation, an extraordinary range of material dating from 1897 to the present day.
So, I mean, as we speak, there are quite a few people in here already, kind of some of them with headphones on, looking at the screen, clicking around. What are they doing and how did they get here?
Well, it's a free space, which is, you know, one of the reasons why there are so many people here. But what happens when you come in is you go to the desk, you get a number, you type in the number on your keyboard, and then up on the screen comes your menu, and it has all of the titles that you can kind of look at. So you can browse, search for whatever you can find. Obviously, depending on what people are interested in, you know, people can spend up to 2 hours here in any one sitting looking through that material. And what a lot of people tend to do is to kind of organize the content, a bit like, you know, sort of playlists like iTunes or whatever. You just kind of organize your content, watch it all kind of back to back. Obviously, some people come in and sort of, you know, just look at a few minutes of things and see if they're interested in stuff.
Eddie, it looks fantastic in here. Why was there felt that there needed to be a change from NFT to BFI Southbank?
The BFI does a lot of things, and I think that most people who came to the NFT probably didn't recognise that the BFI does lots of other things in addition to having a cinema, which is the biggest film and television archive in the world, over 900,000 titles, book and DVD publications. We've done a whole range of activities which I think to most of the public weren't particularly well known, and we thought it was really important that we bring that together under one roof. And in order to do that, we thought it was very important that everybody recognises that all of these things come out of the BFI. So we haven't lost the NFT. We've still got NFT 1, 2 and 3. It's just in a much bigger box marked BFI.
And how much did this cost, can I ask? Because the floor looks great, the lights look great, all these computer screens whizzing around. Fair bit of money here. How much did it cost and who paid for it?
It cost just over $6 million, which, you know, by today's standards is pretty inexpensive, I think, for what you've got here.
Like you get a couple of players for Arsenal.
No, if you're lucky. The money mostly came from the UK Film Council and from the Heritage Lottery Foundation, where we are right now in the MediaTek. They provided a lot of investment into the MediaTek infrastructure and the digitisation of content. Plus, we got money from trust foundations and individuals.
The other thing, Eddie, you had two festivals here pretty quickly. When you launched Optronica and the Gay and Lesbian Film Festival. How was it holding a festival with this new space?
Well, one of the reasons we've expanded is because we do so many festivals, and the LFF, for example, is we've never been able to kind of grasp the nettle with that and do a lot of events here that we'd really like to. So opening with two festivals back-to-back has been great in terms of learning what we can do, what we can't do, but also in terms of bringing a whole bunch of new people to the venue. To hosting a last night party, which was pretty spectacular, I think, to say the least, that we wouldn't have been able to do in the old NFT.
Yeah, it looks good for dancing, the new floor. It's
great for roller disco as well.
I'm glad you told me that. I shall bring mine next time I come down. What have you got planned for the next couple of months over April and May? Some enticing seasons by the look of it.
Yeah, well, we've got, at the moment, we've got this amazing guy, Alejandro Jodorowsky. He's actually here on Friday doing a talk, and he's a kind of cult figure, being pretty much a recluse, and his films haven't really been available since they were made in the 70s and early 80s, and we're showing a few of them here. Holy Mountain, El Topo, which John Lennon described as his favorite film ever, which is an extraordinary weird Western. So the having Jodorowsky here is going to be a real treat. But we've also got a whole season of films right now as well, which are dedicated to Terence Davis, another British maverick whose work is probably not as well known as it ought to be, one of the kind of, I think, the true great British auteurs. We're doing a brand new re-release of Distant Voices, Still Lives, which is probably his key film. So I think, you know, just those two together are happening in the next few weeks, are definitely worth seeing.
And then you've got a Rossellini season upcoming.
Later on, we have a Rossellini season. Later in the summer, we have a whole season dedicated to Andy Warhol. We're showing an enormous amount of material from the Warhol collection. We've also got premieres and previews of films with Julie Christie, Shane Meadows. We're doing a Shane Meadows season. I think for those people who saw This Is England in the London Film Festival last year, you know that this is a great film. It's going to be a film that a lot of people are going to see, and it's going to be an opportunity as well here at BFI South Bank for people to revisit Shane's earlier work, some of which I think is really extraordinary.
Absolutely, all the shorts, Where's the Money, Ronnie, etc. Yeah. I can't wait till you get those This Is England skinheads on their roller skates in the main hall here.
You've seen the future, Jason.
Eddie Berg, the Artistic Director of BFI South Bank, thanks very much for joining us today in the Media Tech.
Thanks.
You're listening to The Observer's Film Weekly podcast, brought to you in association with Extras, the complete second series on DVD. For more information about Extras Season 2 on DVD or Ricky Gervais Live, please visit www.rickygervais.com. Film Weekly is out on the road and down at BFI South Bank, the newly revamped NFT. I'm in the BFI South Bank bookshop, a new repository of all things filmic. I'm surrounded by DVDs of Almodovar, the Coen brothers, Woody Allen. There's books on Francois Truffaut, handsome tomes on Michael Mann, on Cukor, and on Isaac Julian. There's no better place, really, for a film gift than here. And what better place, I thought, than here to review the rest of the week's releases. The Curse of the Golden Flower finds Zhang Yimou back with an intimate epic that tries to blend classical tragedy with sweeping armies. Gong Li's princess quivers a lot as Chow Yun-fat's emperor tries to hold the family together. There's incest, duty, and lots of gold leaf paint in a film that occasionally dazzles but ultimately fails to match thrills with melodrama. Perfect Strangers, or The Curse of the Golden Statue winner, or Whatever Happened to Halle Berry. Catwoman and Gothica is what happened, I don't count those X-Men movies, and Perfect Strangers unites the beautiful one as an investigative reporter with Bruce Willis's leering ad executive. Halle's sure Bruce is behind the murder of a family friend, but who's really keeping the secrets here? Could it be the shifty internet nerd played by Giovanni Ribisi? I would give away the ending of this ludicrously limp thriller, except that the filmmakers made three different endings of their own, and I honestly couldn't tell you which one, if any, they used. Unknown is a rather better slice of cinematic Sudoku, as the viewer and the characters try to piece together the scenario. Four blooded blokes, Jim Caviezel, Barry Pepper, Greg Kinnear and Joe Pantoliano from the jigsawish Memento, wake up trapped in a deserted warehouse, their memories completely wiped. How did they get there? Who are they and how will they get out? Although a minor piece, this is well-acted, slippery stuff that plays games with us and them until the final shot, meaning that Unknown is well worth discovering. I'm joined in NFT's Cavernous No. 2 cinema by a man who's just about to receive a retrospective down here at the National Film Theatre. He is one of the great poets of British cinema, Terence Davis. Welcome to Observer's Film Weekly. Thanks very much for coming on.
Thank you for asking me.
This sees you on a podcast. This puts you in cyberspace and a whole kind of brand new listening experience. It's a bit like radio, except it's on a computer. All this, I presume, terrifies a boy who grew up listening to Billy Cotton's Bandstand.
Well, I mean, I'd know nothing about computers. I'm completely computer illiterate. I mean, I'm terrified of the internet. I think it's got a life of its own. I'm convinced it has. So I don't know what a podcast is, and I hope it goes out into the ether and doesn't offend anybody.
No, I'm sure it will please a lot of people. Most of all, who around the world and around the UK will be listening will be some of them will be slightly perplexed as to who Terence Davis is, because it's been, unfortunately, some time since we've seen your films, yet that you've managed to build up, looking at the retrospective here at the BFI South Bank, as it now is, quite an extraordinary body of work. Does a retrospective scare you now that someone said to you, let's look back, Terence? You're probably thinking I'm still working.
Well, it doesn't so much scare me as I don't sort of feel that I really deserve it, because they were made, all of the films were made with the most modest of budgets and the most modest of intentions. I came from a large working-class Liverpool family, and those days only posh people went into film. I mean, ordinary working-class people didn't, or you had to go to university, and that was the route through which you took. But I never thought that when I made them that there would be this kind of response. But, I mean, I do get letters from all over the world, I mean, which actually astonishes me. I always reply to them because I think it's extraordinary that some lad in North Dakota writes to you. I mean, I find that absolutely extraordinary.
Let's talk about the two key texts, I would say, of the Terence Davis oeuvre that are on display here. That's The Distant Voices Still Lies and The Long Day Closes. Two very, as you say, autobiographical works that were set in working-class Liverpool, the 40s, the 50s. Very personal memoirs from you. But I remember seeing those films and feeling some connection with those, even though I was a million miles away from that era, those people. There's something there that says we all grow up in families that are a bit odd.
We also grow up in families which we think are utterly unique. That's what's universal, I think, that you think your family is like no one else's. Mm. I thought my family was wonderful. I loved that street. I loved that house. And we had nothing, but I loved it with such intensity.
Why did you marry him, Mum? He was nice. He was a good dancer.
Here I go again. I hear those trumpets blow again. All aglow again. Taking a chance on love.
I think one of the unique qualities of the film is its use of song, and in fact I think in Distant Voices it's been timed. I didn't do this, but it takes up half of the film's running time, 80 minutes odd, is devoted to people singing old songs. I love those songs. I love the Cole Porter, I love the show tunes and everything, but I wonder if that culture has completely died out. Oh, do people know the lyrics to songs anymore?
No, it's gone. But you must remember, when I was growing up, Cole Porter was still alive, and pop music was meant to be sung by other people. You had proper lyrics which you could hear. The function of pop music now is not that. It's to dance, or I don't know what its function is now, but it's certainly not to reproduce the lyric. I mean, I can't imagine that in 50 years' time people are going to say, well, let's do some songs from the last Fetch That album.
Do you really not listen to pop music at all?
I detest it. I really detest it. With the arrival of what's his name, Elvis Presley, I remember being taken to see Jailhouse Rock with my sister. I was 11. I was so embarrassed. I thought, doesn't he look ridiculous? I still think he looks ridiculous, that awful voice. And then it's gone downhill ever since. And, you know, there's only one thing worse than pop music. It's British pop music. God. Music to kill yourself by.
Now, many people would, including our dear departing leader, Mr. Blair, would disagree with you. He kind of allied himself to British pop music when he came in 10 years ago. As a filmmaker and one who's obviously a keen observer of the social and political situations around them, how have the last 10 years been in Britain? I mean, obviously, in terms of film, you struggled to get your films made. Have you noticed a difference in the industry?
It's become a cultural desert in terms of, you know, 11-year-olds running the industry who know nothing, who only know television, you know, and tell you every character has got to have a background story. You say, yes, but that'll make it 4 hours long. Are you prepared to fund a four-hour movie? No. Have you seen Singing in the Rain? Yes. Can you tell me what background story Kathy Seldon has? She has none. And funnily enough, people are still watching it 54 years later. Funny that. I wonder why. Politically, it's been such a betrayal. I've always been a socialist all my life. And when they got in, I thought, at last, we've got a radical government that might be as radical as the one just after the war. And we've seen it become more and more Tory It's a complete betrayal. I mean, I cannot tell you. If I had the courage, I'd vote Liberal Democrat, but I still haven't. I haven't reached that nadir yet. But we really have touched the anus mundi in Britain.
My Latin is not what it was, but that's arse of the world. Tony, you're obviously very angry about that situation, and one wonders if you must have a film burning inside you in that case. I have three,
but you can't get them off the ground here.
And is this because you have this unique vision, this unique structure, which has won prizes at Cannes, won festivals around the world, have fallen in love with your way of telling?
But it's not so much that as people who are now running the industry know nothing. They don't even know their own mind. That's what you're up against. You're people who've done the Robert McKee lectures, which are so destructive because they don't mean anything, especially when he bases theory on Casablanca, which had been written as it was being shot. It's just nonsense. There has to be a climax on page six. Who says so? But you've also got people who are ignorant and want to imitate America, which we've always done badly, and it's got to... If it wins an Oscar, then not only are, your next four films... secure, your knighthood is assured, your sainthood is assured. If you don't want to do that, if you want to actually see cinema as an art form that should actually be interpreted, then it's infinitely more difficult, because if all it is, which is largely what British film is now, television writ large, it's completely passive. The audience don't participate and complete the act by interpreting what they see. They simply wait back and sit back and they're told everything. Even big commercial hits in the 50s, which were not very good, things like Love is a Many Splendid Thing, are well-crafted. They're well-crafted, and they expect you to interpret what you see. At the beginning of the film, when Jennifer Jones goes into the party with William Holden, in four shots, they're going to fall in love. That's good craft. It may not be subtle, but it's crafted properly, and you interpret those shots. Now you're told everything. Well, you might as well stay home and clean the oven out. In fact, you might as well stay home and stay in the oven.
There's a downbeat note on which to end. I wouldn't expect anything less, but perhaps a song would be nice. If you were to sing a song for us, which one would it be?
Well, I can't sing. I mean, when I went to drama school, my first singing lesson, after I'd sung it, and my tutor said, "Terence, your voice comes from the same mould as Frank Sinatra. He got the voice and you got the mould." Alas. But the one thing I do love, minor Cole Porter songs, as well as the great ones. But there's one, the opening stanza is, "Ravel is chasing Debussy, the aphid is chasing the pea, the gander is chasing the goosey, but nobody's chasing me." Story of my life.
Terence Davies, they're very much chasing you down here at the new BFI South Bank. As a retrospective of your films is about to play, that's that Long Day Closes, Distant Voices, Still Lies, House of Mirth, Neon Bible, and the Terence Davies trilogy, which are very rare to catch on the big screen, and they'll be here, and you'll be here giving a talk, I assume, as entertaining as the one you've just given us.
I hope so.
Thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome.
What will you give us for them, Mr. D?
Mickey, they're your dad's working boots.
I know, but we've just got to have five, Bob.
What for?
Well, Dad, we've just got to go to the dance.
I don't know. You two are bleeding dance mad.
Oh, go on, Mr. D. Just five, Bob. Don't be snidey.
All right. I'll lend you the money. But take the boots back home, OK?
Oh, thanks, Mr. D. You're a pal. Thanks, Dad.
And be back here by 11. Bleeding dance mad.
Are we fixed for a few singies, Mr. D?
Out!
Competition time now. Last week we were offering a beautiful still from Danny Boyle's Sunshine, signed in gold pen by Danny Boyle himself. We wanted to know your idea for a young director attacking a film staple. The best answer we got was from Ian Connell. A Hotmail account is all we know. Ian, where in the world are you? He suggested Pedro Almodovar doing a paella western for sensitive-minded, soft leather-wearing gunmen on the verge of a shootout on a pretty main street. This week, as we're down at the BFI's glittering new South Bank, we've got a stack of BFI goodies to offer you, including mugs, DVDs and tickets to any event here during the next couple of months. All we want you to do is nominate your ideas for a season that BFI Southbank should be putting on. A season of films that you think would suit BFI's new Southbank complex. Send your answers to podcasts@observer.co.uk. That's podcasts@observer.co.uk. And we'll not only read out the winners next week, but we'll be forwarding your idea to the BFI Southbank people and seeing if your season actually takes place on the big screen down here. That's all we've got time for on this edition of Film Weekly. We've been coming to you from BFI Southbank. As you can hear, the foyer is filling up with early evening filmgoers queuing up to see Florian Donnersmarck's The Lives of Others and anything from the MediaTek. And in the studio behind us, there's a highlights package called London Calling, which shows about 30 different films and images of London over the last 100 years or so. It's exciting down here at BFI Southbank. Unfortunately, we've got no more time on Film Weekly. I've been Jason Solomons. Film Weekly has been produced, as ever, by Paul Noble. And until next week, happy viewing.